Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
You are tuned to a special interview for Radio EcoShock by the extra-environmentalists Seth Moser-Katz and Justin Ritchie. Our guest is Professor Michael McGonigal, formerly with Greenpeace International, then chair of Greenpeace Canada, a teacher of environmental law at the University of Victoria. Back to Seth and Michael.
So what you're saying is that environmentalists traditionally have not questioned the economic rationale of the day, and that's what's really changing?
I wouldn't say it's changing. I don't think environmentalists are still challenging the question of the economic rationale, and we can come back to that. If you look at, say, the left, the movements, the arguments of the left in the 1950s and 60s, it had no environmental component to it whatsoever. Environmentalism was seen as bourgeois, middle class, NIMBYism, right? We like to have a nice, clean environment where we live, and we'll just, you know, regulate or push it somewhere else. And so the left had no recognition of the importance of nature, particularly for the economic system. Similarly, environmentalists had no real appreciation for the critical understanding of the economic dynamics that were driving environmental problems. So neither side was really engaging with the other. And to a degree, I think that's still pretty true. I mean, the left has been more sensitive to environmental issues than in the past, but they're still seen as environmental issues. They're not really understood as deeply on the left as they should be. Meanwhile, I think that's why I talk about exit environmentalism. I think environmentalists still don't understand that. They don't ever look at where wealth comes from.
So maybe you could go a little bit more into the concept of exit environmentalism.
The concept is two things. We got to leave behind the past. We got to exit the old environmentalism. We got to leave that behind, which is what I call liberal environmentalism. And we've got to move into a new environmentalism, which takes us out of that system, which exits that system. We exit the old environmentalism, and the new environmentalism helps us exit the liberal system. And just to give a very simple explanation of it, I teach in the law school at the University of Victoria. And I've taught environmental law. I've done environmental activism and forest policy and forest regulation, international law, environmental law, et cetera, for decades. But the reality is all of those laws, all of these regulations require the state. And basically, you can put environmentalism and environmental law in the same category, because almost every environmental battle really wants new legislation or to take government subsidies or whatever. So it all requires action by the state. But the biggest developer around is the state. It's not Exxon. It's not Bechtel or Toyota or General Motors. It's the state. In Canada, it's the state that's driving oil production out of the tar sands in Alberta and subsidizing it. It's the state that licenses all these large timber tenures and subsidizes fisheries everywhere and builds highways and bails out car companies. It's the state, the state, the state. So what we can achieve through environmentalism and through environmental law is minimal, because the state depends upon development. It depends upon environmental development. So the left has long criticized capitalism, which should be done, but we got to go beyond that. It's not just capitalism, it's the state itself, which is very dependent on capitalism and dependent upon economic growth, and therefore sees its own physical base as being resources to be developed. So exit environmentalism means coming to terms with that, understanding that, and understanding that, oh, we can make incremental things and we got to be realistic, but we're never going to get very far. We're going to be slipping further and further behind, even with our little victories, unless we address the real fundamental dynamics of environmental erosion. And I teach a class and have this kind of approach to law I call green legal theory, which addresses that beyond environmental law. It's a big, big challenge. And it's a big challenge intellectually to see beyond the kind of naturalized world we take for granted, that these are just the systems we have. It's a big challenge there. It's a big challenge historically in terms of the roots of these problems. And they're not 20 or 50 years old. They go way back. And we're talking really the West and the compulsions of the West. And you can go back to the ancient Greeks if you want, and very fundamental problems. So the solutions aren't ones you can just kind of figure out pretty easily, because they are so deeply rooted. And that's a problem. That's why I think it's a problem of discourse and debate. As I say to people, you know, we're running around actively, urgently trying to save things and take action. And that's not what we need to do. We need actually to stop. We need to slow down We need to look at where the problems are coming from and how we understand those. So the metaphor I've been using recently is it's like going to England's, right? And then running across the road. And before you cross the road, do you look to the left, as we do here, and we run out onto the road and we get run over? Because cars in England come from the right. So we have to realize that actually we've got to re-educate how we think and not just look to the right when you cross the street, but get it so ingrained in our body that we automatically look to the right, and then we can survive. We have to do that same sort of thing here. We have to understand that the environmental problems are not specific environmental problems that can be solved by regulation and specific looking at focusing just on specific problems. We have to re-educate ourselves to think about what's behind those problems and automatically see those dynamics behind the problems and address those, not the problems themselves.
As individuals, we're so involved in our governments, we're so involved in these systems and these large-scale institutions that have been, you know, passed down to us from generation to generation. You mentioned the Romans. That's a very, very long time ago. And that kind of mentality has been with humanity for generations and generations. How is it that humans can step past these kind of ingrained ways of thinking, these cultural identities, identifying with one country or one race? How do we see past these kind of large scale problems that are just so fundamentally a part of what it is to be human right now? Is there a way that we can do that without destroying the whole entire culture? Is there a way to pick up the pieces from what we have now and construct something that's constructive and will be able to be sustainable in the future?
I don't know. And you asked me first if there's hope. And given the depth of the problems, I would say the answer is no, that there isn't hope. That the only way that these changes ultimately will be resolved is through responding to a lot of catastrophic changes. And these are not ones I'm making up, right? I mean, climate change is one of the most obvious, but biodiversity loss is another one, huge impacts. And again, this goes with some of the economic problems we're seeing today in the chaos that's happening there. It's a daunting thing. And as a result, people will say, oh, I don't want to talk about that. That's just so depressing. I want to be an optimist. So let's not talk about it. And that itself is a problem because we don't want to confront these things because they make people depressed. But actually, I don't think we need to think about it that way, because there are so many different ways of living that can get us, move us there. So for example, one of the long historical problems that underpins the environmental crisis is the enclosure movement, where beginning, say, in England in the 1300s, but then really taking off later on, those communal, feudal-based structures that protected local communities who then could manage their own commons, their own fields collectively through their own rules, not through the crown or the king or the central government, but themselves, those people were kicked off the land. They were enclosed. Their lands were enclosed and turned into private ownership so that they could be exploited as commodities for trade internationally and for industrialization and so on. That's a huge, long process. That process is also called colonialism, imperialism, where native people were again enclosed, pushed off their lands, stuck on reservations so that the state could get access to those lands. That's a process that's gone on for hundreds of years, several hundreds of years. Well, local activism is anti-enclosure. One of the things that we can be doing right now is understanding the nature of enclosure. And the Occupy movement is a very good counterexample to enclosure, saying the space, we have to look at the spaces of capital. We have to look at how things are played out and to reclaim those spaces. Very difficult to do. These spaces are now being colonized by iPhones, where people are walking down the street and don't even realize that they live in a space because they're all clicking away on their iPhones. The momentum of the colonization of space continues. But the resistance to that is also very direct, whether it's the Occupy movement or native rights, indigenous people throughout the world, the World Social Forum, or these are being put forward, or all kinds of, you know, movements to reclaim the commons or counter alternative currencies and so on. But these things have to be understood not as kind of nice things that are done on their own, but as important because they're going at the fundamental roots of the dynamics of central power, and that they're significant in that way. They're going to not easily be achieved. I mean, you see, for example, the history of indigenous rights in Canada, continuous co-option. So it's that sort of understanding translating into very specific actions, including in my own town, for example, in Victoria, there's an area called Fernwood, where all a lot of university students live in kind of a neat neighborhood, and they're actually trying to take that old neighborhood and turn it into one big farm where people, different people are growing different stuff in their backyards and creating a herbal apothecary where they distribute herbal medicines and so on from there. I mean, it's that type of reclamation which has deep roots, and you can take action and love doing it because it's such a neat thing to be doing, working in your own community doing that, but also knowing you're doing it in response to hundreds and hundreds of years of colonialism, which have to be countered if we're going to survive.
Starting with reclaiming space seems like a tangible step, something that I can do, but I see some barriers to that. One, definitely the elites and the way that they have lashed out against the Occupy movement, you know, just simply people getting together and talking has seen tremendous crackdowns, not just in North America, but around the world. And then also other people who might minimize it and say, oh, you know, there's so many big problems in the world and you're just going out and gardening in your community and gardening with other people. How is that really going to address the bigger problems? What would you say to both of those issues?
Both of those issues, I would say the answer is the same. We have to talk about it. We have to understand what the problems are. And I think there's a level of, and maybe I'm sounding too much like an academic, but I'm an activist, and I see it in both ways, in both places. There's a desperate need for deeper understandings about the dynamics of the systems that are driving us. And there's a blockage to people wanting to talk about that. The Occupy movement, I think, was a brilliant set of strategies last year and into the spring, because it so disrupted the consciousness of the elites, and at the same time got a lot of public support from people, and disrupted the consciousness because it did things that didn't fit. And it didn't fit because, and it's so sophisticated. I mean, for example, well, just tell us what you want was one of the responses. Tell us your demands. And the response is, we don't have any demands. We don't want to put forward demands. And that's just, well, that doesn't make sense. Well, of course it makes sense if you think that the problem is who the demands would be made to. It would be made to the political power structure. Well, the political power structure is itself the problem. And, you know, there's been a lot of discussion in the last 20 years about rights, the weakness of rights, environmental rights, or women's rights, because rights themselves are granted by the systems that themselves are problematic. So the Occupy movement, by refusing to make demands, kind of disoriented the system, people's understandings, and in a very sophisticated and powerful way. Capitalism was talked about a lot in the Occupy movement. The nature of inequity, the profound inequities were talked about in ways that haven't been done before. I think there is a possibility of opening up this dialogue, a broader dialogue with elites, but it can't be one that people shrink back from. People have to be very clear of what's going on, for example, in Montreal right now with these demonstrations against tuition fee increases in Quebec. And people don't realize why students are so entrenched about that, because it's a social democratic tradition that's being challenged by making university less and less accessible to people in comparison with, say, Scandinavian countries where tuition is often free because they want it to be accessible to everybody. These battles are not going to be won easily. They're going to have to be won through a lot of clarity, a lot of strength against co-opting forces, but particularly through dialogue, through putting forward over and over again very strong explanations and clear explanations as to the dynamics that we take for granted and why they're not working anymore.
As one of the co-founders of Greenpeace, you have an interesting perspective on the Occupy movement. You mentioned that they don't really have a lot of demands. Is this the next sort of step in organizational dynamic, is not really having a demand to say, we want to stop this pipeline, or we want to stop killing these whales? It's just to kind of take yourself out of the system and express dissatisfaction with the whole system in general. Is this the next step in what people need to be doing?
I don't think there's any one strategy. I think that, I mean, blocking pipelines to the West Coast to prevent the delivery of oil from the tar sands to China is absolutely imperative. I think it's a really good thing to be doing. But the argument that has to be made there is not just we don't want oil tankers on the coast because those oil tankers are going to eventually have an accident and cause damage. Sure, spent years fighting oil tankers, part of my work for like 10 years. So I totally relate to that and I know the damage they can do. You can make those arguments, but the deeper arguments need to be made, such as that we should be leaving this stuff in the ground. To the extent that we're continuing to dig up and look for more sources of fuel of any type, whether it's wind energy or tidal power or biofuels or tar sands, we're just extending the system. What we need to do is to run out of energy. We need to slow down our demands. We need to reduce our demands. One of the absolute most important criteria for an exit environmentalism is what's called demand reduction. Not new supplies, reducing demand. Capitalism can't handle that. So we ought to not just talk about oil causing environmental problems, but that we need to reduce the use of oil, we need to reduce the use of fossil fuels, we need to reduce energy, period, because they all have unacceptable costs. Well, when we do that, we confront the reality that we need more energy if we're going to grow, because capital needs to grow. Well, then we've got to talk about the growth dynamic of capitalism. And then we've got to talk about, well, and the state is addicted to that. So the problem with blocking the Enbridge pipeline is one about needing to have a different form of economics, a post-capitalist economics, and a different form of government, which, unlike the state, which is completely addicted to economic growth. And unless we do that, that pipeline is going to happen because the growth system needs it. So what's the alternative to that? Well, for example, what about indigenous people all along the pipeline having a veto? So maybe local communities, we need a new constitutional arrangement where local communities can veto assaults on their landscape and can say, no, we don't want that. So that's the discourse that needs to change, not necessarily the actions. And actions like the Occupy movement were great because they went to the heart of financial capital. They went to Wall Street. They started in Wall Street and they refused to move and they wanted to talk. They didn't mount demands. They wanted to talk about the problems. And that's what's needed. So yes, it's a new form of environmentalism, but it's a new form of environmentalism that's tied to the old forms of environmentalism, but transform it. Pull us out of a liberal environmentalism that thinks, oh, if we just have better environmental assessment processes, we have good decision making. No, ain't going
to
work.
So it's about saying we want to leave that oil in the ground because we want our economic system to either fail or develop a new economic system that's better?
We want to leave that oil in the ground because pumping out more oil from the ground is just going to exacerbate climate change, because it will just increase supply when the economic problems we have is a supply-driven economy. And we need to be able to develop new forms of economy which do not require that sort of supply. I'll give you a very specific example. Why don't we get rid of the automobile? Let's just get rid of the automobile. If we got rid of the automobile, or at least for 99% of its uses, we would have different forms of transportation, bicycles, for example. We would have different patterns of urban development, urban organizations. We'd have more public transit. We'd have more equity. People would not have to spend, as they do today, $10,000 per year to maintain an automobile. $10,000 per year, which sounds ridiculous, but you put the price of a car in, say a car costs $20,000, you have it for 10 years, there's $2,000, but people buy them on credit, so now you got to pay your interest payments, you've got to pay gasoline, you've got to pay maintenance, you've got to pay insurance, you've got to pay parking. People spend on average $10,000 a year for cars. Okay, so we don't want oil because oil is going to drive climate change. So we're going to reduce our use of energy. We reduce our use of energy, we need to come up with other forms of transportation. So let's get rid of the automobile. Well, we get rid of the automobile, we got better cities. People don't waste money on these cars that are just propping up an old system. We have a healthier population because people get around by bicycle. We have whole different infrastructure for people who use bikes and so on and so forth. We begin the change. We begin the change we need to make. It's not such a big deal. The problem is, why do we need cars? Well, look at China. The last 10 years, China's gone from being a bicycle-based society to being the biggest purchaser of automobiles in the world. 1.4 billion people all want cars. If that isn't stupid, I don't know what is. Why are they doing that? Because they've bought into the Western model of development. big capital investments needed. How are they going? How is China going to get capital investments? The only way China is going to get capital investment in from the West is playing the West game. So rather than leapfrogging past the Western industrial capitalist system, it's bought into it. And it's going to cause massive problems, as we all know, with coal and so on. And it's not meeting the needs of its own people. I have a Chinese student, graduate student here, who says that every 5 minutes in China, a new violent protest erupts. Every 5 minutes. It's not meeting the needs of its people. It's not meeting economic needs. It's crazy. We need to talk about that. People can see it. They feel it in their gut. But we need to justify our actions and explain our actions in light of those types of systemic understandings. We don't do that. We just say we don't want a pipeline because it's going to break up and cause damage on the coast of BC.
Thanks for joining us today, Michael, to talk about exit environmentalism on Radio EcoShock.
This is just the first part of our interview with Michael McGonigal. For more episodes and for the full version of this episode, come check out our website at www.extraenvironmentalist.com.
I first heard Michael McGonigal's talk on exit environmentalism in a badly recorded YouTube speech at the University of Victoria. It seemed too important to waste. Seth Moser-Katz and Justin Ritchie volunteered to do this interview for Radio EcoShock as part of their longer podcast called The Extra Environmentalist. Just Google that or go to extraenvironmentalist.com. That's an irregular podcast which takes the time, sometimes up to 2 hours, to talk in depth with some of the new edges of green. We have time for just a quick sample from another Extra Environmentalist podcast that I enjoyed so much, Dr. Michael Huseman, author of the book Technofix. That is episode number 37. Find a link in my blog at ecoshock.info. The Technofix podcast runs 1 hour 54 minutes, and I've sliced out a couple of samples running less than 10 minutes. It's definitely just a scratch of the surface, a teaser to encourage you to hear the whole thing.
Welcome to the Extra Environmentalist.
Your opposable thumb means nothing.
This is what we want to be. We don't want to be Americans or Germans or English. We want to be extra environmentalists. Always feel wherever you go that you are a stranger, the outsider. The one looking in. This is the viewpoint that makes all places the same to you.
Hello and welcome to The Extra Environmentalist. I'm your host, Seth Moser-Katz, along with my co-host, Justin Ritchie. And today is an amazing day, isn't it, Justin?
Today is an incredible day. We are here speaking with Michael Huseman, and I know I'm mispronouncing his name, so I apologize to him and anyone who can actually pronounce his name properly. And we're speaking with him about his book that he co-wrote with his wife, Technofix, which is the definitive book about technology and all the misconceptions that fuel our modern notion of techno-optimism.
We have techno-optimism, especially in developed countries like the United States. I follow the techno-optimism blogs very closely, and I consider myself a techno-optimist extraordinaire.
Dr. Michael Huseman, thanks for joining us from Arizona today. You're a research scientist with a special interest in sustainability and critical science. You've specialized in environmental biotechnology for more than 25 years, and we're here today to talk about your recent book, Technofix.
Yeah, it's nice to be here.
So, Michael, after a career in developing technology, what prompted you to start writing Technofix in the first place?
Yeah, I come from a rather long family tradition of science and engineering. My great-grandfather had a PhD in chemistry, and both my father and my grandfather both were mechanical engineers. So when I grew up, there was no question what my profession should be. I should clearly study engineering. And so my motivation early on, when I was even a teenager, was, oh, I want to study engineering to help society, to help the environment. And so I picked chemical engineering and went off to college. But after I got my PhD in chemical engineering, I joined a very large multinational company, and I was somewhat naive. I joined them in the environmental research department, and I thought, oh, they're going to use environmental research to clean up the environment, to help the environment. And I was, as I mentioned, a little bit naive. They really use the environmental research to change regulations, to make regulations, environmental regulations, more lenient. And so at some point it actually came to a clash between me and management. You know, I defended my research plans, my experimental design in front of all these managers and said, well, this is the best design because it's unbiased and objective. They said, we are not really interested in this. We would like you to change this to get better results at the end. And I said, well, I can't do it. I want to do unbiased research. And then one manager told me, well, Michael, you are not hired here to do science. You can do science on the weekend. And so I left that company. And soon afterwards, however, I realized that even with supposedly unbiased research, when I looked through many, I must have read thousands of research papers and also research proposals in the environmental area. And also, most of that research was unbiased and objective. I sort of felt that most of the research actually was not really helping that environment that much. There was not much implementation of these ideas to protect and help the environment. And so I got more and more frustrated with this lack of progress. And so I started thinking about what's going on here with science and technology. Can science and technology really help the environment? Can it really solve the problems of society? And so it took me really to study this question for 15 years. This is not just a short project. And at some point in the middle of this project, my wife Joyce joined me, and she has a doctorate in statistics and a master's degree in anthropology. And so she could make an interesting contribution to this project because of her cross-cultural perspectives from this anthropological background. So it became a very interesting project for many years. And as a result of our long collaborative research, we believe that Technofix is one of the most comprehensive and thought-provoking critiques of modern science and technology.
What is it like working with your wife so closely on such intricate projects?
Well, it is interesting because it results in rather intense discussions over breakfast and lunch and dinner. You know, it's very interesting, but of course it results also sometimes in conflicts in terms of conflicting viewpoints, but it results in a more interesting overall perspective at the end of the process. So we wrote different parts of the books and then edited each other's part. So there was also some cross-fertilization at that level. So that was interesting.
In taking the title Technofix, can you tell us why you chose that title and why technology won't save us?
A technofix is basically an attempt to solve a problem with technology by addressing only the symptoms instead of the root cause. And it's called a fix because it does not really result in long-term lasting solutions. So technofixes are attempts to solve either problems caused by previous technologies or to solve social problems. Let me give you a few examples about solving problems caused by previous technologies. We have a whole other series of technofixes appearing here on the horizon for climate change mitigation technologies. And then the third problem with fixes is they cover up symptoms and often make problems worse. And so that's why technofixes are a bad idea.
That was a sample from the Extra Environmentalist, podcast number 37, Technofix, with Dr. Michael Huseman. Get the whole thing at extraenvironmentalist.com. Still wondering what to think? If it's safe or cool to hope? Me too. Keep tuned to Radio EcoShock at our website, ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you so much for listening.